In this week's Classical Music According to Yehuda, Alan Chartok and Yehuda Hanani discuss the history of the piano recital.
This institution of the piano recital is really a throwback to the era of the romantic, heroic age of the 19th century piano recitals. It was introduced by Franz Liszt, actually.
Sure.
Franz Liszt gave it the title, recital.
This
was named by Franz Liszt. And as you say, a solitary person walks onto the stage and confronts a large black piano. The effect is not unlike that of a lion tamer in the circus, or better yet, a gladiator in the amphitheater, pitted against a menacing beast as a throng of spectators watch in suspense. Will he subdue it, or will he be devoured by it? You know, the piano has those big jaws when it's open. The scenario changes drastically when you add a second player. Now, all of a sudden, you have intimate dialogue on the stage, dramatic, tender exchanges between two characters are now at play on the stage. And even though those brilliant bravura passages are being tossed back and forth between two players, like in a dazzling tennis match.
Or a volleyball game.
Or volleyball game, if you wish, yeah. What I want to do is tell you a little bit briefly about the meteoric rise and the decline of this tradition, the instrument itself and the virtuoso cult that was attached to it, that surrounded it. Liberace's...
I was going to mention him because you said big black piano. I was going to say except the white piano in Liberace's case. But I didn't say it out of respect for you, but you went and raised it.
I asked for it. Liberace's ermine robe and his studded rings and encrusted embossed pianos are the kitschiest imitation of this tradition. It's a caricature and a symbol of its decline, really. It's Liszt gone Las Vegas.
Sure.
That's what it is. So the piano is...
And of course there was Clara Schumann. We shouldn't forget about her because she was a great pianist and made a lot of money doing it, didn't she?
She did. She was a celebrity in her day. And she was a contemporary of Liszt.
Okay.
The two of them really rivaled for the first, being the leading figure in the piano world during the 19th century. So the piano itself is constructed of 10,000 pieces, wood, metal, hide and cloth, was invented by Bartolomeo Cristofori in Italy. He called it clavicembalo col piano forte, a keyboard instrument that could both play soft and loud. Now, by 1850, an invention that had been a novelty just 50 years before had become the center of musical life all over Europe, at home and in concert halls. In Paris alone, in one city, Alan, there were 180 piano makers. In England, 300 piano firms were producing more than 20,000 instruments a year. We are talking about 1850. Then, of course, it crossed the ocean and arrived here, where families like Chickering and Steinway advanced the design, and the American piano became a world standard. Now, if we move on to by 1910, the U.S. was the world's largest piano manufacturer, with 300 companies producing more than 350,000 pianos yearly. The piano was everywhere, from upper crust music salons to gold rush bordellos in Colorado. And in between those two extremes, it became the gathering point, the cultural hearth of every aspiring middle-class household in America. You probably remember those days.
Absolutely.
Every living room had a piano there, and people were singing and playing, and this was part of the center of the household.
And everybody took lessons.
That's right, exactly. So, and accordingly, the voice of the piano was suitable and was adaptable to all kinds of music. It was good for Mozart and Schubert. It was good for jazz, for Scott Joplin, and for arrangements of popular and stage songs. It was quite a triumph for an instrument to make. And as you just mentioned, if you think of the industry that evolved around it, a slew of piano teachers, method books, sheet music for home consumption, every eligible maiden and every bachelor were required to take lessons. Etiquette books instructed a woman how to play for an admirer and how a courtship should be carried out at the keyboard. Now, this brings us, of course, to forehands.
Oh, I get it.
You get it.
It's a little forehand.
This was an intro, playing. Alan, right. So we come to the forehand story. The potential for physical and spiritual bonding for two people sharing a bench at the piano is quite obvious.
And every once in a while, a little mistake and the hands touch.
Yeah. Okay, we are getting there. Now, that's something you may not have known. Nietzsche.
Uh-huh.
Composed forehand music.
No kidding.
Yeah. And he said that, now I'm quoting, it may be taken as a divining rod for a good marriage. And Robert Schumann writes, a forehand piece allows us reveries together with our beloved, provided she plays the piano. And of course, his beloved played the piano quite well. She was
best of the best.
Exactly. Yeah. She was really a star.
And when he was sick, she went out and did all the work.
She continued touring. They had seven children in the house.
No.
Yes.
Wow.
They had seven kids, and she would just go on the road and play concerts while he was in an insane asylum.
Yeah, he was, yeah. Robert. Yeah.
Yeah. Then there are the physical temptations, when heads almost touch and fingers intermingle on the keys.
Oh, boy.
Now, composers, aware of this forced intimacy...
Oh, boy. I see it coming. they purposely wrote that way. Yeah.
Yes.
So that the thing is to touch. I love it.
Absolutely. They created pieces of music, works, where hands overlap.
Oh, boy.
Fingers interlock, and contact is maximized. Now, all this, Alan...
That's a sin.
Is, all this is from the keys and above, but below the keys, the pedals.
Oh, the pedals.
Oh, yeah. The possibilities for playing footsies.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I love it.
So there you have it, this Victorian duplicity. Etiquette books, propriety, virtue, harmony, all that on one end, and erotica, seduction, and scandal. Well, all at the piano.
Do the newspapers cover this kind of stuff?
I don't know. That's your area.
Right. Absolutely so.
So, just to get serious again, in addition to becoming standard home entertainment, forehand also made it possible for music lovers to be introduced to symphonic works. Because before recorded music, it was rare for one person to hear all of Beethoven's 9 symphonies played in a lifetime, during a lifetime, played by an orchestra.
Uh-huh.
It was a rarity. All these works were arranged for forehands by Liszt and other pianists, and that's how people really heard them for the first time.
Fascinating.
I told you I was going to tell you about the meteoric rise and the decline of this cult, this instrument.
What happened?
So, okay, it all begins in the 1920s. First came the mechanical player piano. You know what it was.
Not only do I know it, we had one. We had one in our house.
Oh, really?
Absolutely.
With the rolls?
With the rolls, yeah. It was a big standard upright. It was an upright.
Yeah?
And my brother, who was at Music and Art, didn't like the way it looked, so he decided he was going to take all of the varnish off the piano. And one night he worked like crazy, and there it stood for the rest of its time, half done and half not done, or maybe a third done, not done. But it had those little keys. You opened up the thing in the front, and there you'd press something over to the left or the right, and you had to have a roll in the piano.
And the keys were moving, but no one was playing.
The keys would move.
You know how it was advertised when they were selling them? Perfection without practice.
Oh, yeah. You could pretend. You could put your hand on the keyboard. And I want to say that you're right about romance and what young women are expected to do, because my wife is quite a pianist, and she'll sit there and play for me, and I'm always
and you
taking...
Were, you were smitten.
Then and now.
Beautiful.
45 years later.
Great. Then, of course, came the phonograph and the radio, and they permanently undid this piano culture. By 1990, just to continue the statistics for a moment, the 300 piano factories in this country
We're down to?
Decreased to fewer than 10.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And that year, 1990, 4 million electronic keyboards were sold.
That tells you a lot.
And
about
it tells
where
you the story.
Going.
Exactly. And the piano now was labeled acoustic. So we just had a concert, a special holiday concert with two brilliant young musicians who happened to be married. So they didn't
have, they're married because
they didn't have to play footsies in front of the audience.
Well, they already did. That's how they
exactly,
got together.
Exactly. But they played a part of the holiday concert was an arrangement of the Nutcracker Suite by Tchaikovsky for four hands, for two players.
Wow.
And it's so brilliant. So let's celebrate together by listening to this piece.
Great.
Alan Chartok speaking with cellist Yehuda Hanani in our segment, Classical Music According to Yehuda. To hear this segment again or catch up on past conversations with Yehuda, visit wamc.org. To learn about Yehuda's Close Encounters with Music series in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, visit cewm.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.